explanation. All his medical records are here. He has no outside identification except for his social security number, and he's never used that for anything. He doesn't appear to have ever had a job that wasn't paid in cash under the table, including this one. He doesn't have a whole lot of friends and very few family members. In other words, if you wanted to use someone for a medical experiment, he's perfect, Redhouse said. That's about right, I said. Vicente fumed some more. I knew Johnny Sani, he said to me. Yes, sir, I said. I had heard that. What I had actually heard from Claw Redhouse was that in his earlier days, Vicente had carried a torch for Johnny and Janice's mother, June. It was never reciprocated, as far as anyone could tell, but that didn't make it any less real to the current Navajo Nation president. Old flames die hard. Vicente pointed to the display, which had reset to the beginning of the video, with Johnny Sani's head in the frame. I want you to find out who did this, he said, and then I want you to snap their head off. I will do what I can, Mr. President, I said. I was not entirely sure if protocol called for Mr. President, but I didn't think it would hurt. Anything we can do to help, you let us know, he said. Officer Redhouse has already been an immense help, I said. I'll let him know if there's anything else I need. Vicente nodded and left the room. When are you going to release the body to the family? Roanhorse asked after Vicente had gone. Soon, I said. Our specialist is finishing up his examination of the network in Sonny's head. As soon as that's done, I think we can release the body. I understand you're helping the Sonnies get Johnny back here, she said. I glanced over at Redhouse at this comment. His expression was blank. Arrangements will be taken care of, yes, I said. The person helping is asked to remain anonymous to avoid any possibility of spectacle. I'm wondering why this anonymous person decided to help, Roanhorse said. Because somebody should help, and this somebody could, I said. You do understand what anonymous means, I said to Redhouse after Roanhorse had left the room. Redhouse pointed after her. That's the speaker of the Navajo Nation and also a good friend of my mom, he said. You try to keep a secret from her. Don't let it get back to the Sonnies, I said. It won't, Redhouse said. And now you better give me something to do to help you, because you put a target on my head with the president. I was trying to make you look good, I protested. I appreciate the gesture, Redhouse said, but you're not the one he's going to be calling, asking for updates. There is something you can do for me, I said. Go through the nation's medical records. See if there's anyone else like Johnny Sani, someone who got sick with Hayden's, got meningitis, but then recovered. What do I do when I find them? Tell them not to take any jobs from strangers, for one, I said. Redhouse smiled at that and departed. I called Tony. Trying to get a report ready, he said, as soon as he connected. I won't try to stop you, I said, but I do want you to check something specific for me. Can I charge extra? Tony asked. As far as I'm concerned, sure. Then tell me what it is. Check the code for anything that could knock out the integrator, I said. Like, make them unconscious? Yes, I said. The integrator unconscious, but the body still functional. Can't be done, Tony said. Integrators aren't just passive receptacles for their clients. They need to be aware to assist. I believe you, I said. Check anyway. And I suppose you want this for the 7 o'clock. That would be nice, I said. I'm charging you holiday rates, Tony said. Works for me, I said. Get to it. Already gone, he said, and disconnected. I looked up and saw Johnny Sani looking at me. I looked back at him, silently. Chapter 18. All right, you are not going to believe this shit, Tony said, walking up to our standing table at Alexander's Cafe in Katie's Alley, Georgetown. Van had designated it as her place to interrogate Brenda Rees in a relaxed atmosphere. We were at a standing table because cafes disliked threeps hogging chairs, a small piece of technological bigotry that I didn't really give a crap about one way or another. Who are you? Van asked the other threep, walking up with Tony. Taylor Givens, she said, before I could answer for her. Tony and Chris's roommate. Tony told me we were stopping here on the way to a movie. Van looked at me to see if I cared about Taylor hearing what we were about to talk about. I gave her a small body movement that effectively communicated the thought, meh. Van turned back to Taylor. This is a confidential discussion, so don't talk about it. If you want, I can turn off my hearing, Taylor said. I do it often enough around Tony anyway. Hey now, Tony said. Van smiled. It's fine. Just don't repeat anything. Tony's technically a patient of mine, Taylor said. I file it under physician's confidentiality. Van turned back to Tony. What shit are we not going to believe? Chris, you asked me to look for code in the software that knocks the integrator unconscious, Tony said. Yeah, I said. And you found it? No, Tony said. I told you that you needed the integrator to be conscious to assist their client, and that still stands. What the software actually does, or can do, is much weirder. It robs the integrator of their free will, and then it wipes their memory. Explain this, Van said. She was suddenly very attentive. Integrators stay conscious for two reasons, Tony said. One, it's their body and they have to have veto control over any dumbass thing a client wants to do, like pick a fight or jump out of a plane without a parachute. Two, because integration isn't totally clean, right? The neural network transmits the client's desires to the integrator's brain. The brain picks it up and moves the body and makes it do what the client wants. But sometimes the signal isn't strong enough and the integrator needs to step in and make it happen. The integrator has to read intent and assist, Van said. I suddenly realized that Tony didn't know Van had history as an integrator. Exactly, Tony said. So knocking out an integrator isn't just morally wrong, it also defeats the purpose of integrating in the first place, which is giving the client the illusion of a functioning human body. A body with a knocked out integrator is going to have a hard time walking or doing anything with anything approaching standard dexterity. But someone found a way around this, Van said. I think so. How? The code I'm looking at plays with the integrator's proprioceptive sense, Tony said. It gives the integrator the sense that they can't perceive their own body. It paralyzes them, Taylor said. She had clearly not turned off her hearing. No, Tony said. See, that's the sneaky part. You don't want to paralyze the integrator because then the client can't use the body. What you want to do is rob the integrator of any sense of their body, while at the same time leaving the body receptive to input. The integrator has lost control of the body, but the body is ready to be used. The integrator experiences lock-in, I said. Exactly, Tony said. They go Hayden. But unlike us, Tony motioned to the three of us, excluding Van, the body is good to go. But if the integrator is locked in, then the body isn't good to go, I said. You said it yourself. They need to be there to assist. That's the other sneaky part, Tony said. In addition to locking in the integrator, the code fools the brain into thinking the signal from the client is also the signal from the integrator. So when the client says, raise the arm, what the body hears is both the client and the integrator saying it, and it raises the arm, or moves the leg, or chews the food. Or jumps out of the airplane without a parachute, Van said. Or that, Tony agreed. You said it also wipes out the memory, Van said. Yeah, Tony said. Although maybe it's not accurate to say it wipes it out. What it does is inhibit the integrator brain from forming long-term memories of what the client is doing. Everything exists in short-term memory only. As soon as the client disengages, everything the client was doing with the integrator body is flushed from the brain. It feels like lost time, I said. But not for the client, Van said. Probably not, Tony said. Assuming the client's brain is working normally, memories will be recorded normally as well. So the client can do whatever they want and the integrator won't remember it, Taylor said. Right, Tony said. But here's the really fucked up thing. The integrator won't remember any of it. But while it's happening, the integrator feels it. The code isn't suppressing the integrator consciousness. It doesn't have to, because it's cut off proprioception and is dumping the consciousness into the short-term memory buffer. Writing code to suppress integrator consciousness would just be a waste of time. So, for every second the client has the integrator locked in, the integrator feels like she's drowning, Van said. Yeah, Tony said. Or that feeling you get when you're dreaming and you can't move. Or, well, being a Hayden. How does this relate to the hardware? Van asked.
It relates very well, Tony said. The hardware is optimized to the software, not the other way around. The network has a dense concentration of filaments accessing the dorsal spinocerebellar tract, for example. That's the part of the brain that handles conscious proprioception. Once you know the software, the hardware design makes perfect sense. This is a purpose-built network.
Designed to take over someone's brain, Van said.
Pretty much, Tony said. At the end of the alley, I saw a familiar face. I think I see Brenda Reese, I said. I waved until she saw me. She smiled, waved back, and started walking toward us.
And we have to get going if we want to catch our movie, Taylor said to Tony.
Last question, Van said. Any way this software can work on a network that's not this one?
You mean on a different integrator, Tony said.
That's right, Van said.
Long answer or short answer, Tony said.
Taylor groaned.
Short answer.
Seems unlikely, Tony said.
Brenda Rees reached into her handbag, pulled out a gun, and aimed it at Van. I yelled gun and pulled Van down at the same time, covering her body with my threep. One bullet cracked my back panel and another pinged off my arm. I felt an excruciating pain with both and immediately turned off my pain perception. The patio of Alexander's erupted in screams and panic. I grabbed my stunner and wheeled up to return fire. Rees was taking off down the alley with the panicked crowd.
Oh, fuck! Van said. I looked down to see her bleeding from the shoulder. Taylor was already there, applying pressure. Van looked up at me.
The fuck are you doing, Shane? She said. Get her!
Taylor, I said. I got this, she said, not looking up from Van's shoulder. I ran after Rees. Rees had run left onto 33rd Street. As I got onto 33rd, I saw her go left again onto M. There was the sound of another gunshot, followed by screams. I turned the corner and was nearly knocked over by people running. I went into the street to avoid them and saw Rees halfway down the block, scanning for me. I didn't have a shot. There were still too many people around. I ran straight to her instead. She saw me when I was about 20 feet from her, managed to raise her gun and take a shot at me. It either missed or nicked me in a way that I didn't feel at the time. I barreled into her and knocked her into a wall, taking a chunk of her leg out as it jammed into a fire hose coupling. Her gun flew away. My momentum smashed me into the wall a fraction of a second later. I let go of Reese. She scrambled away, limping out into the street, reaching for something else in her handbag. I trained my stunner on her and prepared to fire, and then held fire when she turned, and I saw the grenade in her hand, pin-pulled.
You've got to be fucking kidding me, I said.
Reese smiled, limped farther out into the street, and released the lever. Then her face changed. She looked confused for a second, and then saw what she had in her hands. She screamed, dropped the grenade, and turned to run away from it. I ducked my head in against the wall and waited for the detonation. It punched me into the wall. Fragments from the grenade embedded into the wall above me and jammed into the glass storefronts all around me. I looked up and around to see if there were any casualties. The only people I saw were running away too quickly to have been wounded. I looked over to Reese. The grenade had taken off her legs. I went over to her and was amazed she was still alive, looking down at her body. Her left arm was a mangle. Her right arm pawed at her leg. She saw me.
I can't hear anything, she said to me shakily. I can't hear. Help me.
I'm right here, I said, even though she couldn't hear me. I took her right hand and held it. She started to cry.
I didn't want this to happen, she said. I didn't choose this.
It's all right, I said. On my inside voice, I was calling 911. She stopped looking at the mess of her legs and looked at me.
You, she said. I remember you. Dinner. I remember.
I nodded to let her know I remembered her, too.
He wasn't there the whole time, she said. I was there the whole time. I was. But not him. He wasn't.
She stopped talking. I held her until she died. 5 minutes later, I looked up to see Detective Trin looking down at me, gun drawn, two other cops behind her, both aiming at my head. "Don't you start," I said. "You want to explain this to me, Agent Shane?" Trin said. "It's complicated," I said. "I have time." "I'm not sure I do." She motioned to Reese with her gun. "Who is that?" she said. "For your purposes, her name is Property of the FBI," I said. I got back to Alexander's and found Van on a stretcher, oxygen mask on her face, EMTs prepping her for travel. "I'm fine," she said. I glanced over to Taylor, who was wiping blood from her threep with a towel the EMTs gave her. "She's not fine," Taylor said. "She's got a bullet in her shoulder. It looks like it missed anything major, but she's still on the way to the hospital. I would take her to Howard so I could look after her myself, but Georgetown is closer. I'll go with her there. I know some people. She'll get looked after." "Thank you, Taylor," I said. "I didn't want to see that movie anyway," she said. "What should I do?" Tony asked. "I need you to go back and look at that software some more," I said. "Why?" "Remember when you said that you didn't think that software could work on a different neural network?" "Yeah," Tony said. "I have a pretty good idea you were wrong about that," I said. "Get back to the morgue. I'm sending you something." "You're kidding," Tony said, when he realized what I was saying. "I wish I were," I said. "Shane?" Van said. I turned to my partner. She pointed. "Your back is cracked." "It stopped a bullet," I said. "I'm fine. I'll get the panel replaced tomorrow." "Thank you." "You owe me." Van smiled at that. "Reese," she said. "Dead."
"How?"
"Grenade."
"The fuck?"
Van said.
"I don't think she was herself," I said. "You think she was like Sonny?"
"Yeah," I said, "I do. And there's another thing. Before she died, I think she was telling me that the night Loudon Pharma went up, she wasn't integrated with Samuel Schwartz the whole time she was at my dad's dinner party. She was his cover while he went off and did something else."
"Loudon Pharma," Van said.
"Maybe," I said.
"You're going up against a corporate lawyer on that one," Van said. "Good luck with that."
"I'm on it."
"Your housemates," Van said.
"What about them?" I asked.
"If Reese was integrated, then whoever was riding her saw them."
"I'll call in your address," Van said. "We'll get agents over there."
"Add some for yourself," I said. "You were the one she took a shot at."
"I was the only one she took a shot at," Van said. It took me a second to get what she was saying.
"Oh, shit," I said, and disconnected.
"Whoa," Jerry Riggs said, startled, as I sat up in the Cayman Zephyr. "Jesus, kid, you have to warn me when you do that. That threep hasn't moved the whole time I've been here."
"Jerry," I said, "you have to go, now."
"What's wrong?"
"I'm pretty sure someone's coming to kill me," I said.
Jerry laughed at this and then stopped.
"You're actually serious," he said.
"Jerry," I said, "please, get the fuck out already."
Jerry gawked at me, set down the book he was reading, and walked quickly to the door. I looked at myself in my cradle, peaceful, and then I headed out the door myself. Mom and Dad were in the kitchen, having a private dinner with the help gone for the day. They both looked up at me as I came in.
"Chris," Dad said.
"What happened to your 660? Mom asked, looking at my threep.
"The lights went out." "Get out of the house," I whispered to them. "Do it now."
The Zephyr had a night vision option. I switched it on and looked around. I reached out and picked a knife out of the butcher block. After a moment, I reached out and took a heavy iron skillet off the hook it was hanging from, prepared either way. I reached my room as someone was opening the sliding glass door that led to my room's front patio. The man was stocky, short, and stepped through with his handgun pointed down and in front of him. He spotted the constellation of lights that surrounded my cradle, powered by backup batteries that would last for 12 hours. The lights would give him more than enough illumination to put a bullet into my brain. He stepped through, back mostly to me, and raised his handgun. He looked thoroughly professional. Except that he didn't check his six. Or his 7, more accurately, which is where I came in at him from, swinging the skillet directly into his head. He went down, gun firing 2 shots. The first bullet punched a hole in my cradle.
There was a searing pain in my side as small chunks of the cradle drove themselves into my flesh. The second shot went wide, up and over the cradle, to connect with the sliding door that led to my room's back patio. It shattered. I got the shooter with the pan, but not as solidly as I could have. He kicked out a leg and jammed it into my knee. If I were a human body, I would have gone down screaming. As it was, I lost balance and fell, dropping the skillet. I fell, and he rose, lining up another shot. I took the knife I still had in my hand and jammed it hard into the top of his boot. He screamed and leapt back, grabbing at the knife to remove it. I jumped up to push him further off balance, and he wheeled the gun up at me, firing. I felt the bullet enter my threep on my left waist, tearing down through the leg. A maintenance alert immediately popped into my field of view, telling me that I had entirely lost control of my left leg. I knew that because I fell face first onto the room tiles, cracking the faceplate of the Zephyr as I did so. I rolled and looked up to see the man leaning up against the doorframe of my room, keeping his weight off his injured foot, lining up his shot. The knife was still in his foot and the skillet was behind me. There was no way I was going to stop him in time. "Hey," my father said, and the man turned just in time to take a shotgun blast in the side. The shotgun blast took me by surprise, but probably less than it surprised my assassin. He flew straight out of the doorframe, spinning, landing face down less than a foot from me. He didn't groan or breathe. He was dead. "Chris," Dad's voice. "I'm all right," I called back. "Both of me. One more than the other." I gathered my useless leg up behind me and sat up. Mom ran up, flashlight in hand, flashing it in my eyes, blinding me. I dialed my eyes back to normal mode. "Throw me the flashlight," I said. She did. I ran it up and down the assassin. There was a gaping hole where a few of his ribs used to be. Dad got him at pretty close range.
"Is he dead?"
Mom asked. "He's dead," I said.
"You sure?"
"Pretty sure," I said.
"Jesus," Dad said. "I just killed a man."
"Yeah, you did," I said. I aimed my flashlight over at Dad. "Don't take this the wrong way, but I think you just ended your Senate run." Dad didn't have anything to say to that. I think he might have been a little bit in shock. I took the body and rolled it over. Whoever it was, he was young, dark-haired and dark-eyed.
"Who is he?"
Dad asked.
"I don't know," I said.
"Why would someone want to kill you?" Mom asked. "I'm an FBI agent," I said.
"It's your third day on the job."
"Fourth," I said. I was feeling a little punchy myself. I'd had a long day. "Mom, Dad, I need you to do something for me. When the police come, the story needs to be that this was a house robbery gone wrong. Tell Jerry that's the story, too." "He's in your room," Dad said. "Your threep has been shot." "I came home for dinner with you two," I said. "We heard noises. I insisted on taking point because I'm the FBI agent." Dad looked dubious. "Come on, Dad," I said. "You're one of the most famous men on the damn planet. I think you can sell that story."
"Why do you need us to tell this story?" Mom asked.
I looked over at the dead man in the room. "Because I need the person who did this to believe I don't know what he's up to." "Chris," Mom said, "the man who did this is dead." "That's exactly what I want him to think," I said. Mom looked at me like I was nuts. My field of vision lit up with something other than a maintenance alert. It was Claw Red House. I told my parents to hold on, and I took the phone call. "You okay?" Claw asked. My punchiness was apparently evident by voice alone. "Ask me that tomorrow," I said. "I did what you asked and looked through the nation's medical records," Red House said. "I got clearance from President Vicente."
"What did you find?"
"There were two people who matched what you were looking for," Red House said. "One of them was a woman, Annie Brigman. She died 3 years ago. The man she was driving with fell asleep with her in the car and drove off the road. She wasn't wearing a seatbelt. The car rolled over her."
"The other one?"
"His name is Bruce Scow," Red House said. "I tried to look him up. He went missing from his home about 3 months ago." "Hold on a second," I said. I looked over to my assassin, took a picture of his face, and sent it off to Red House. Tell me if that's him, I said.
That looks like him, Red House said. You know him?
He's in my parents' house right now, I said. Dead.
That can't be coincidence, Red House said.
No, I said. No, it can't.
What do you want me to do with this? Red House asked.
I need you to wait for me, I said. It won't be long. I just need a little time.
You have earned credit, Red House said. You've got time.
Thanks, I said, and disconnected. I could hear the sirens coming up the driveway.
Chapter 19. An hour with the Loudoun County sheriffs, who seemed delighted to buy into the home robbery gone wrong story. I left just as the media and Dad's media people started to arrive. That was something they could handle. At some point, I would need the FBI to take possession of Scow's body because I needed to confirm what was in his head. I would worry about that later. My threep in D.C. was where I left it and had a police guard, although whether it was a guard or a cop waiting to arrest me wasn't clear for the first couple of minutes. A diagnostic showed that the damage to the threep from the bullet into the back was worse than I originally thought, and I had a couple of hours before it locked up entirely. I reflected on the fact that, in a single day, I had managed to seriously damage three separate threeps. An hour arguing with Trin in the Metro Police about having Reese's body released to the FBI. The point that Reese had just attempted to assassinate an FBI agent did not seem to convince Trin all that much. Finally had to resort to having people over my head at the Bureau go over her head in the Metro Police. By the time I was done, Trin no longer wanted to be my friend. Ever. Suited me. Another hour with the FBI recounting the Reese attack, making up a suitable lie about leaving the scene to check in on my parents and otherwise catching up my place of employment with the day's events. I focused on the Reese attack rather than the whole day. Did not volunteer to speculate on causes, and no one asked me to. For now, Reese's attack was being treated like a single event, unrelated to anything else me and Van were doing. This also suited me. Finished up just as my threep ground to a halt. Managed to get to my desk. I would have to schedule for the local Sebring Warner dealership to pick it up for repair tomorrow. In the meantime, I checked the inventory for visitor threeps I could use. There were none. We had called in reinforcements for the march. Visiting agents were borrowing the five threeps we had on hand. Fine, I thought, and started looking for rentals. There were none. The march meant that every rental threep in the district, Maryland and Northern Virginia, was rented through Monday. The closest rental threep available was in Richmond. It was a Metro Junior Courier. The hell with this, I said, and finally exercised my rich person privileges. I called up my Sebring Warner salesman on his personal number and told him that if he could get to his store and have a threep ready for me in 45 minutes, I would pay full price plus an extra $5,000 as a tip for dragging him out of whatever Adams Morgan singles pit he was currently casting about in. An hour later, I walked out of the D.C. Sebring Warner dealership in a 325K, a few steps down from the 660 XS, but at this point it seemed likely I would have it for about a day before I completely trashed it in the line of duty, and took a cab to Georgetown Hospital, calling Van to let her know I was on my way and in a new threep. I found her in the emergency room, arm in a sling, arguing with an orderly. "We need to have you in the wheelchair until you exit the building," he said. "I was shot in the shoulder, not the legs," she said. "It's hospital policy. I can't move this arm, but the rest of me works fine. So if you want to try to stop me, see where it gets you. The good news is, you're already at the hospital." She walked off, leaving the annoyed orderly behind. "Van," I said. She looked over at me, taking in the new threep. "Shane?" "Yeah," I said. "Prove it." "I royally pissed off Trin tonight," I said. "I think she hates me more than she hates you." "Oh, I doubt that," Van said. "But if you got her even halfway there, I'll buy you a drink." "I don't drink," I said. "Good," Van said. "Then you buy me a drink. Come on, I know a bar." "I don't really think you should be hitting the bars tonight," I said. "You have a hole in your shoulder." "It's a scratch," Van said. "A hole in your shoulder from a bullet," I said.
It was a small bullet, Van said. Fired by someone trying to kill you. All the more reason I need a drink. No bars, I said. Van looked at me sourly. Let's go back to my place, I said. Why would I want to do that? Van said. Because we have to catch up, I said, and because there are agents there watching over the place, so you won't be killed in the night. I have a couch you can sleep on. Van continued to look unconvinced. And we'll stop on the way to get a bottle of something, I said. Better, she said. I entered my townhouse with my public ID up so that my housemates wouldn't panic when they saw me. Taylor came over and stopped when she looked at Van. They let you out, she said. It's more like I didn't let them keep me in, Van said. Even without facial expression, I could sense disapproval radiating from Taylor, but then she let it go. You two need to access the news, she said. I'm not sure about that, I said. They have a video message from Brenda Rees, she said. It went live on the net just before she shot at Agent Van. She pointed to the living room. We have a monitor there for guests. I have my glasses, Van said. But we went into the living room anyway, fired up the monitor to the news channel, which had a copy of Rees's video. In the video, she talked about the injustice of Abrams Kettering, how it was causing suffering among so many of her clients, and how everyone was to blame.
There are no innocents among the non-Haydens, she said. They allowed this to happen. Cassandra Bell said it, and I believe it. This is a war on a disabled minority. Well, I am now a soldier in this war, and for me, the battle starts tonight.
Do you believe this? Van asked me as we watched the video again. Hell no, I said. You caught the reference to Cassandra Bell. I did. Another act of violence, ostensibly perpetrated at her behest. Anyone killed tonight? Van asked. Aside from Rees? I asked. Van nodded. No. There were some people who were stampeded and other injuries and property damage from the grenade, but the only person she shot at was you. And you, Van said. I got hit, I said, but that was because I was protecting you.
And that would go against her story anyway, Van said.
So you and I know she was gunning for me, but her story will muddy up the waters. When the morning shows go live tomorrow, they're going to tie this into the Loudoun Pharma attack. That sounds about right to me, I said. Van didn't say anything to this, but touched the monitor to bring up the latest news. The top story aside from Reese's attack was the shooting at my parents' house. Van pulled up the story and watched it. A burglar, Van said after the report ended. That's what I told my parents to say. Think it will float? There's no reason for it not to, I said.
How are your parents? Van asked.
Now that they've got their people and responses in place, they'll be fine, I said. Dad's in shock a little. Killing a man ends any thought of him running for Senate. A man defending his home doesn't play so poorly in most parts of Virginia, Van said. No, but it's balanced out by the image of a really big, angry black man with a shotgun, I said. Even Mom's ancestors being gun runners for the Confederacy isn't going to make up for that. So I'm pretty sure a party rep is going to come around tomorrow and tell him they would be delighted for him to endorse the candidacy of someone else.
Sorry.
It'll be fine, I said, eventually. Dad's probably got a week of think pieces and commentary about him and the shooting to get through before he can do anything else. A normal person would be able to get through it in private. Dad has to worry about what it means for his legacy. And the burglar, Van said. A Navajo named Bruce Scow, I said. And he's like Johnny Sani? As far as we can tell so far, probably, I said. We'll need to get into his head to confirm.
Another remote-controlled integrator, Van said.
Looks like, I said. Van sighed and then pointed at the liquor store bag I still held in my hand, containing a bottle of Maker's Mark bourbon and package of Solo cups. Pour me some of that, she said. Make it a tall one. How tall? I asked. Don't get me drunk, Van said, but just short of that would be fine. I nodded. Why don't you head up to my room, I said. I'll bring it up to you in a minute. I pointed in the right direction and then went into the kitchen, which was a characteristically bare Hayden kitchen, save for the pallets of nutritional liquid. Taylor, whose room was on the first floor, saw me go in and followed. You're getting her a drink, she said. The alternative to getting her one here was getting her one at a bar, I said. At least here I can cut her off if she gets sloppy.
What she really needs at this point is some sleep, not bourbon, she said, pointing to the bottle.
I'm not going to disagree with you on that, I said, opening the bottle. But she's not going to do that at the moment. In which case, I might as well make her comfortable, because we need to do some work.
And how are you doing? Taylor asked.
Well, you know, I said, opening the solo cup package. Today, I fought with a Ninja 3, saw two women view the last video from a dead relative, had a woman explode 20 feet from me, and watched my dad kill an intruder with a shotgun. I took a cup and poured the bourbon into it. If I had any sense, I'd take this bottle and attach it to my intake tube.
I've seen people do that, actually, Taylor said.
Yeah? I asked. How does it work for them?
About as well as you'd expect, Taylor said.
Hayden bodies are sedentary and in general have low alcohol tolerances to start. Our digestive systems are used to taking in nutritional liquids, not actual food and drink. And then there's the fact that the disease changes our brain structure, which for a lot of Haydens increases the propensity for addiction. So they're all fucked up is what you're saying. What I'm saying is there's nothing as fucked up as a Hayden alcoholic. I'll keep it in mind, I said.
You need sleep too, Taylor said. Professional opinion.
I'm not going to disagree with you on that either, I said. But for all the reasons I've just outlined, I'm a little wired right now.
Is it always like this? Taylor asked.
My job?
Yes.
This is my first week on the job, I said. So far?
Yes. How do you feel about that?
Like I wish I had decided to be the typical rich kid and been a sponge on my parents, I said.
You don't really mean that, Taylor said.
No, I said. But at the moment, I really want to feel like I did. Taylor came over and rested a hand on my arm.
I'm the house doctor, she said. If you need help, you know where I am.
I do, I said.
Promise me you'll try to get some sleep tonight?
I'll try.
Okay, she turned to go.
Taylor, I said.
Thanks for tonight. It means a lot to me that you helped my partner. That's my job, Taylor said.
I mean, you saw me help a man who 2 minutes earlier was planning to bash my head in with a bat. I wouldn't do any less for someone you care about. Chapter 20. You took your time, Van said, as I walked into the room. Taylor wanted to talk, I said, walking the bourbon over to her. She's worried about the both of us.
Seems fair, Van said, taking the cup. Both of us survived an assassination attempt tonight. I'm worried about the both of us, too.
She took a sip from the cup.
Now, she said, I'm going to tell you a story.
I thought we were saving story time until after the march, I said.
We were, Van said. But then your friend Tony showed up with his discovery, and then someone tried to put a bullet into my head, so I've decided that sooner is better than later for story time.
All right, I said.
This is going to wander a bit, Van warned.
I'm all right with that, I said.
I'm 40, Van said. I was 16 when I got sick. This was during the first wave of infections when they were still figuring out what the hell to do about it. I lived in Silver Spring, and there was a party I wanted to go to with friends in Rockville. But Rockville was quarantined because there was a Hayden's outbreak. I didn't care because I was 16 and stupid. Like any 16-year-old, I said.
Exactly.
So me and my friends got into a car, found a way in that didn't have a roadblock on it, and went to the party. No one at the party looked sick to me when we got there, so I figured it wouldn't be a problem. I finally got back home around 3, and my dad was waiting for me. He thought I was drunk and asked me to breathe so he could smell my breath. I coughed on him like an asshole, and then I went to bed.
Van paused to take another sip out of her cup. I waited for what I knew was coming next. 3 days later, I felt like my entire body had swelled. I had a temperature, I was raspy, my head hurt. Dad was feeling the same way. My mother and my sister felt fine, so my dad told them to go over to her sister's so she wouldn't get sick.
Not a good idea, I said. They had probably been infected but weren't showing symptoms yet.
That's how Hayden spread as far as it did. No, Van agreed. But this was the early days, so they were still trying to figure these things out. They left, and Dad and I watched TV and drank coffee and waited to feel better. After a couple of days, we both thought the worst was over. And then the meningitis hit, I said. And then the meningitis hit. I thought my head was going to explode. My father called 911 and told them what was going on. They came to our house in hazmat suits, grabbed us and sent us over to Walter Reed, which is where second-stage Hayden's victims were sent. I was there for 2 weeks. I almost died right at the beginning. They pumped some experimental antibiotic in me that gave me a seizure. I tensed up so hard I ended up breaking my jaw. Jesus, I said. What happened to your father? He didn't get any better, Van said. The meningitis stage fried up his brain. He went into a coma a couple of days after we got to Walter Reed and died a month later. I was there when we unplugged him. I'm sorry. Thanks, Van said. She took another sip. What really sucks is that my dad was one of those people who made a big fuss out of wanting to donate his organs when he died. But when he died, we weren't allowed to donate any of his organs. They didn't want someone to get his kidneys and the Hayden virus, too. We asked Walter Reed if they wanted to use his body for research, and they told us that they already had more bodies for that than they could use. So we ended up cremating him. All of him. He would have hated that. What happened to your mother and sister, I asked. Did they get sick? Gwen had a low fever for about 3 days and was fine, Van said. Mom never got sick at all. That's good. Yeah, Van said. So, then I spent my next 3 years being self-destructive and in therapy because I felt guilty about killing my dad. You didn't kill your dad, I said, but Van held up her hand. Trust me, Shane, she said. Anything you'd say on the topic I've already heard a couple thousand times, you'll just annoy me. All right, I said, sorry. It's okay, just let me tell the story. Another sip. Anyway, somewhere in all of this, they discover that some of the people who survived the second stage of Hayden's without being locked in can integrate, can use their brains to carry around someone else's consciousness. Walter Reed has me on file, so they contact me and ask me to come in and get tested, so I do. They tell me that my brain is, in the words of one of the testers there, absolutely fucking gorgeous. That's not bad, I said. No, Van agreed. And they ask me to become an integrator. And, at the time, I'm at American University, ostensibly majoring in biology, but actually mostly just getting high and screwing around. And I think, why not? One, if I become an integrator, the NIH will pick up the rest of my college and pay off half of my existing student loans. Two, when I complete training, I'll have a job, which at the time was something that was getting harder to come by, even for college graduates, and it was a job that wasn't going to go away. Three, I thought it'd be something that would make my dad proud, and since I killed him, I figured I owed him. She looked at me to see if I was going to say anything about her killing her dad. I didn't. So, I finish up my degree at American, and while I'm doing that, I get the neural network installed in my head. That gave me a panic attack because for the first few days it was giving me these massive headaches, just like the ones I got with the meningitis. She motioned to her head in a circular motion. It's those goddamn wires moving into position. I know, I said. I remember it. If you're a little kid when they install it, you get the joy of feeling it move around as you grow. That sounds like a nightmare, Van said. They told me when they were installing it that there were no nerve endings in the brain, and I told them that they were high because what was the brain but one massive nerve? Fair point. But then the headaches go away and I'm fine. I go into Walter Reed every couple of weekends, and they run tests and condition my network and generally compliment me on my brain structure, which they say is perfectly tuned to receive someone else's consciousness, which I figure is a good thing if this is going to be my line of work. Then I graduate, and I immediately start work on the integrator program, which is more testing and studying the underlying brain mechanics of how integration works. They're of the opinion that the more you understand it, the better you're going to be as an integrator. It won't be a mystery or magic to you. It'll just be a process. Are they right? Sure, Van said, up to a point. Because it's like everything, right? There's a theory of it, And then there's the real-world experience of it. The theory behind integration didn't bother me at all. I understood the thought mapping and transmission protocols, the concerns about cross-interference between brains and why learning meditation techniques would help us be better receptacles for our clients and all that. It all made perfect sense. And I wasn't stupid, and I had that gorgeous brain of mine. Another sip. But then I did my first live integration session, and I literally shit myself. "Wait, what?" I said. Van nodded. "For your first integration session, they have you integrate with a Hayden they have on staff. Dr. Harper. It's her job to integrate with new integrators, to walk them through the process. Everything she does, she explains as she does it. The idea is no surprises, nothing wild, just simple things like raising an arm or walking around a table or picking up a cup to drink some water. So I meet her, and we shake hands, and she tells me a little bit about what to expect, and she says that she knows I'm probably a little nervous, and that's perfectly normal. And I'm thinking, I'm not nervous at all, let's just get on with it. So, she sits down, and I sit down, and then I open the connection, and I feel her signal requesting permission to download. And I give permission, and Jesus fucking Christ, there is another person inside my head, and I can feel her. Not just feel her, but feel what she's thinking and what she wants. Not telepathy, like I can read her thoughts, but what she's wanting. Like, I can tell that what she really wants is for the session to be over because she's hungry. I don't know what she wants to eat, but I know she does want to eat. I can't read her thoughts, but I can feel every single one of them. And it feels like I'm suffocating or drowning. "Did you tell them?" I asked. "No, because I knew I wasn't acting rationally," Van said. "I knew that whatever I was feeling was an overreaction. So I tried to use all those relaxation and meditation techniques they've been training us on. I use them, and they seem to work. I'm starting to calm down. And as I'm calming down, I realize that everything I've been feeling has happened in the space of 10 seconds. But fine, whatever, I can handle this." Then she tries to move my arm, and I just freak the fuck out, and my sphincter lets go. "Because your arm is moving without your intent," I said. "Exactly," Van said. "Exactly." She took another sip. "Because this is what I learned about myself that first day. My body is my body. I don't want anyone else in it. I don't want someone else controlling it or trying to. It's my own little space in the world and the only space I have. And to have someone else in it, doing anything to it, sends me into a panic." "What happened then?" "She immediately breaks the connection and comes over to me and gets me to stop panicking," Van said. "She tells me not to be embarrassed and that my reaction is a common one. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there in my own shit, trying not to rip her little mechanical head off. No offense. None taken. She says we'll go ahead and take a break so I can get cleaned up and get something to eat, and then we'll try again. Well, I do go and get cleaned up, but I don't get anything to eat. Instead, what I do is go to the nearest bar in borrowed hospital scrubs and have them line up 5 shots of tequila, and then I down them one after another in the space of about 90 seconds. And then I go back in for the second session, and I fucking nail it." "They didn't notice you being drunk off your ass on tequila," I said. "I told you that I spent a few years being self-destructive," Van said. "It wasn't good for my liver, but it was good for being able to drink and still function." "So, in order to integrate, you had to be drunk." "Not drunk," Van said. "Not at first. I had to have enough that I wouldn't panic when someone got inside of me. I figured out that if I could make it past the first 5 minutes, I could handle the rest of the session. I was never happy, but I could tolerate the intrusion. And then, when it was done, I would go and have another couple of drinks to take the edge off." "You didn't consider just not being an integrator," I said. "No," Van said. "You have to spend a minimum amount of time as a professional integrator, or else you have to pay them back for everything they paid out for your education and training. I couldn't afford that. and I wanted to be an integrator. I wanted to do the job. I just couldn't do it strictly sober. Got it, I said. And at first, that really didn't matter, Van said. I got very good at calibrating just how much alcohol I needed to get through a session. I was never drunk and my clients never noticed. I got good reviews and I was in demand and no one ever figured out what I was doing. But it didn't last, I said. No, Van said. Another sip. The panic never went away. It didn't become more manageable over time. It got worse, and by the end, it got a lot worse. So I upped my therapeutic dose, as I like to call it. They noticed. They didn't notice, Van said. By that time, I was very good at my gig. The physical aspect of being an integrator I could mostly do on autopilot. What I couldn't do as well was put on the brakes. Sometimes a client wants to do something you didn't agree to in your contract. When that happens, you need to pull them back. If they fight you on it, you pull the plug on the session and report them. If it's bad enough, or if they pull that stunt on too many integrators, then the client gets blacklisted and isn't allowed to integrate anymore. It doesn't happen often because there are so few integrators that most Haydens don't want to jeopardize their chances of using one. Van drained her cup. You had it happen, I said. Yeah. What happened? I had a teenage client who wanted to know what it was like to die, Van said. She didn't want to commit suicide, mind you. She didn't want to be dead, but she wanted to know what it was like to die. To have that second just before the end, when you realized you couldn't escape, and that this was it. She realized that, unlike most people, she was in a position to realize her fantasy. All she needed was to push an integrator at the last minute. Then, she would have her moment. And since everyone knew integrators could stop their clients from doing anything stupid, it would look like it was the integrator who did it, and that the client was the victim. All she needed was the integrator to be inattentive just long enough. How did she know? That I was the right integrator for her plan? I nodded. She didn't. She didn't have a long-term contract, so she went into the NIH integration lottery and got who she got. It just happened to be me. But the rest of it, well, she planned, Shane. She knew what she was going to do and how she was going to do it and had it down so well that when we integrated, I couldn't feel what she had planned for me. All I could tell was that she was excited about something. Well, most of my clients were excited about something when they were with me. That was the whole point of using an integrator, to do something that excited you with an actual human's body. How is she going to kill you? I asked. Her stated purpose for wanting an integrator was that her parents had managed to get her a special event at the National Zoo, Van said. She was going to be allowed to hold and play with a small tiger cub. It was a birthday present. But before she did that, she wanted to walk around the mall to look at some of the memorials. So we integrated, we walked around the mall, and then we went into the Smithsonian Metro Station to go to the zoo. We stood near the edge of the platform and watched the train roll in. At the last possible instant, she jumped. I felt her tensing, felt what she wanted to do, but my reaction time was too slow. I had 4 tequilas before we integrated. By the time I could do anything about it, we were already in the air and almost off the platform. There was no way for me to do anything about it. I was about to die because a client killed me. Then I was jerked back and fell hard onto the platform as the train flew past. I looked up and there was this homeless guy looking down at me. He told me later he'd been watching me because of the way I was pacing and looking down the track for the train. He said he recognized what I was doing because at one point he thought about jumping in front of a train himself. He recognized it, Shane, but I didn't. What happened to the girl? I pulled the fucking plug on her, that's what, Van said. Then I had her charged with attempted murder. She said it was me who tried the jump, but we got a court order for her personal effects and records, which included a journal where she described her planning. She was charged, and we cut a deal where she got probation, therapy, and was forever blacklisted from integrating.
You were easy on her, I said.
Maybe, Van said.
But I just didn't want to have to deal with her anymore. I didn't want to have to deal with any of it. I was almost killed because someone used me to see what it was like to die. Everything my panic attacks are trying to tell me about integrating had just come true. So I quit.
Did the NIH try to get you to pay back your training in college?
No, Van said. They were the ones who assigned the client to me. They didn't know the reason I almost died was because my reaction time was dulled by alcohol, and I didn't volunteer the fact. As far as anyone could tell, the problem was that the selection process didn't screen for garden variety psychopaths, which was true enough. I promised not to sue. They let me go without a fight. And the selection process was changed to protect integrators from dangerous Haydens. So I ended up doing some good. And then the FBI tracked me down and said they were looking to build up a Hayden-focused division and thought I might be a good fit. And, well, I needed a job. And here we are, I said.
And here we are, Van agreed. Now you know why I stopped being an integrator, and why I drink and smoke and fuck like I do. Because I spent years working in a state of alcoholically managed panic, and then someone tried to kill me with my own body. I don't drink as much as I used to. I smoke more. I fuck about the same. I think I've earned all of them. I won't argue with you about that. Thank you, Van said. And now, this fucking case. It's every single thing that made my brain scream come to life. When I almost died, it was on me. I wasn't paying attention, and someone took advantage of that inattention to make me do something I wouldn't do. If I had died, at the end of the day, it would have been for the choices I made, to drink and to stay in the integration corps. But this is someone taking away the integrator's choice. It's locking them into their own body and making them do things they wouldn't do, that they would never do, and then throwing them away. She pointed to me. Brenda Reese. She didn't kill herself.
No, I said. I saw her face when her client disconnected. She tried to get away from the grenade. She had no control before that.
She was locked in, Van said. Locked in to her own body until there was nothing she could do about what was going to happen. We need to figure out how this is happening, why it's happening. We have to stop it.
We know who is behind it, I said.
No, we think we know who's behind it, Van said. It's not the same thing.
We'll figure it out.
I want to share your optimism, Van said. She held up her cup. I'm not entirely sure I've had enough of this to do so.
You might have had enough, I suggested.
Not yet, Van said, but soon. Think maybe a shot more will do it. I took the cup and walked down the hall toward the stairwell, pausing at Tony's room as I did so. His body lay there, appearing to sleep. His threep was missing. I wondered if anyone remembered to feed Tony today, but then saw his nutrient levels were topped off. Taylor did that, I thought. It's good to have friends. I went to the kitchen, poured out a shot of bourbon, and brought it back to my room. Van was asleep, snoring lightly.
Chapter 21. I woke up at 9:30 and for a moment panicked that I was late for work. Then I remembered that since I was shot at twice last night, I was told to take the day off, unless I wanted to talk to the mental health staff. I preferred the day off. I skimmed through some email, waiting to see if my brain would be willing to collapse back into sleep. No luck. Awake it was then. I got into my threep in the apartment and looked around. Van wasn't on the couch. I assumed that she had headed back to her place. Then I heard her voice downstairs. She was in the family room with Taylor and the twins watching the monitor. On the screen, there was a riot. It was happening on the mall. What the hell happened? I asked, looking at the monitor. Van looked over, cradling a cup of coffee. You're up. I gestured at the monitor. Maybe I should have stayed asleep.
Then when you woke up, it would have been worse, she said.
Someone firebombed a tour group of Haydens, Taylor said.
Seriously, I said.